Welcome to Business Watch here on Business Day TV. Well, the final report of the Zondo Commission into state capture, with the handing over by Chief Justice Raymond Zondo of his 1,800-page final report to President Cyril Ramaphosa on Wednesday. Really, the lengthy and tortuous road towards uncovering the truth about state capture, corruption and fraud in South Africa has now reached its long-awaited formal interrogative conclusion. Although the Zondo Commission has often been criticized for not meeting its deadlines, after nearly 4 years of investigation by the Zondo Commission, the massive and cumulative amount of evidence revealed by it nonetheless remains overwhelmingly large to manage. I counted the pages, 5,190 of them. Globally, gauges of factory activity in Japan, Britain, the Eurozone and the US have all softened in June, with US producers reporting the first outright drop in new orders in 2 years. That's in the face of slumping confidence. And bonds rallied hard as well on hopes that bets on aggressive rate hikes would have to be curtailed, with German two-year yields down 22 basis points. That's their biggest drop since 2008. European Central Bank and Federal Reserve speakers are going to be watched closely later today, as will British retail sales and German business confidence. Beyond that, the main worry is obviously is what all of this means for company earnings as we head into the second quarter. Well, lots to discuss with Warwick Lucas, head of Galileo Securities, Raymond Parsons, professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Isaam Klunga, chief economist at Alex Forbes. Warwick, back with us. So it's the old firm again. US bond returns so far this year, probably one of the worst ever on record. Equity returns in the US also amongst the worst on record so far. So I think it's fair to say that sentiment is on the deck. It's all doom and gloom, and often that's very typical of a bear market, and also a very important characteristic of the final stages of a bear market. Do you think the bottom is close?
Well, Michael, I'm not sure whether it's necessarily the bottom of a bear market or just simply a part of a rite of passage being made. I think what is relatively different this time compared to many years of potential bearish incidents is the lack of the Fed put. Now, what do I mean by that? I think there was a perception by markets that whenever markets fell, the Fed would simply intervene and cut rates, and all would be hunky-dory. And there was an assumption, I think, by equity markets that this was Fed policy. Well, I can safely say it's not Fed policy. I mean, the Fed, and other central banks for that matter, look at stock markets as a kind of lead indicator. And when they see markets falling, they see it as a lead indicator of something that the market thinks is going to happen. Now, where we've seen examples of the Fed put was 1987, and again in the late 90s, we saw it in 2009, in 2015 and late 2018 and so on. The Fed has come to the party, but always, I think, because the equity market has given concerned signals about the state of the economy. Now, what's this different this time is that there isn't lots and lots of available deflation to naturally roll prices over and to justify the actions of a Fed in cutting rates. If the Fed cuts rates now, they will simply ignite inflation. They do not have the option of a Fed put. The Fed, I think, looking at the stock market, would probably agree with the sentiment that, oh dear, the economy is in danger of becoming rather soft. I mean, we've already seen data from the Atlanta Fed GDP now. I mean, that's hit zero already. And I quite like that nowcasting report, and that it basically gives you an updated sense of where will GDP be now using current data.
Yeah.
I think the reality is that markets are in the dangerous position where the potential upside, and I mean there is potential upside in that prices are much better than they used to be in the past few years. And sure, there's lots of investors still out there suffering the China complex, i.e. there is no alternative.
But what's the difference? I just work on that point. What's different potentially this time round? And I hear what you're saying, where we're heading back to a more normal environment. And you cast your mind back 15 years. The Fed funds rate was around 4% before the global financial crisis. You didn't have to rely on the Fed as heavily, and inflation was under control. The economy was growing. Employment was pretty good in the US. We're heading back to that point. There's been a lot of pain this year that had to be endured to get here already. I mean, the NASDAQ is down well over 30% from its recent highs, or the S&P in bear market territory. And I guess the big question that markets have now got to ask themselves is whether or not inflation will be reined in, brought under control, if we see the Fed funds rate back up at 4%, and how solid the U.S. consumer is to absorb all of this. Is it going to be a soft or a hard landing, and therefore will company earnings be able to recover, and not only recover, probably from these valuation levels, show some attractive entry points? Do you think at this stage we're at that point?
So this is a more tricky cycle for the Fed. For one thing, a big part of the problem is it's the supply side problem. So even if inflation came into balance, I mean, we still got assorted supply side issues, supply chains and so on to get sorted out, as well as the whole commodity complex. So there's actually limits to what the Fed can realistically do. But the Fed is also in the position that, first of all, it can't allow inflation to become a regular makeup in the psychology. The second point is, and it's a relatively sort of debated point, I guess. I mean, I listened to one very important economist pass a comment that he felt that the Fed could not access the inner Paul Volcker because the degree of debt to GDP, or the amount of debt out there, rendered that potentially impossible because it's such a large debt to GDP. Well, I would argue that's the exact reason the Fed has to be aggressive, for the very simple reason that whatever debt you've issued is a historical interest rate. You've locked that in and you already got that. But your new debt, your new bond issues, are going to be issued at a much higher coupon rate. And if inflation persists, whether it's in the US or Europe, etc., those central banks and those governments are going to be issuing, or sorry, I should say those governments are going to be issuing debt on much higher coupons. And suddenly their budgets, which were already a little bit iffy, are going to go way out of whack. And the only way to deal with that is to make sure that you prevent inflation from becoming structural now. If you leave it and it becomes structural, you're going to have a hell of a problem balancing your budget, because you're going to continually be issuing debt at much higher coupon rates. And suddenly, that debt to GDP of above 100% that you were so comfortable with because you had a savings glut and because you had deflation, suddenly becomes a real whip for your back.
And that becomes a real structural problem for global economies. Isaac, talk to me about the health of the global economy. And I mentioned in the introduction those PMIs around the world starting to flash amber in the cockpit to say this looks like it could be a global economic slowdown. Would you go along with that?
Absolutely, Michael. I think a lot of indicators are showing or signaling that we are entering into a significant slowdown in terms of global economic activity. If you look in the commodity price across the board, we have seen this week at least significant decline. Brent crude oil down 8.3%. Look at things like platinum and copper down 5% and 14%. Agricultural commodities, the Bloomberg index down 11%. So across all commodities, there is a signaling to say global growth is likely entering a slowdown. But I think we have to accept that we are not going to move in a linear fashion. This is what you might call a dead cat bounce, essentially. Some improvement within a bear market. And we are seeing that in all the bond yields that was that you alluded to. From US 2-year to all emerging markets except for, Turkey and China. All of the other bond yields, they declined, this week. You look at emerging markets, CDS spreads, they've also declined across the board, which means, there is some sense of some risk appetite returning this week, but I think it's not going to last because the central banks have not yet signaled stopping interest rate hikes. Inflation has not yet peaked, and we don't have a sense that it has peaked, even in our own economy. UK inflation 9.2%, the highest, you know, since 1982, and it hasn't shown any signs of peaking. So we have to accept that central banks will continue to hike rates until either the economy breaks or markets breaks or inflation comes back closer to 2%. Neither of those are present at the current moment. So what we're seeing in market might not last for long.
So those are some pretty significant global headwinds that face us. Raymond, if we now turn our attention to the political economy, and that is really what the Zondo reports are dealing with here, and bearing in mind that we're not political scientists, but it has a bearing on business confidence, it has a bearing on whether or not captains of industry have confidence in investing in the South African economy. What do you initially take away from this voluminous last tome of the Zondo report?
Hi, Michael. No, I think quite rightly, we mustn't underestimate the significance and the impact of the Zondo report in its totality from an economic point of view, let alone the good governance aspects. There's a lot at stake for South Africa in how we now carry this debate and its implementation forward in the months ahead. So I would just like, in that context, to having emphasized how important the implementation and the prosecution of the outcomes must be seen to be done, just to lift out three or four points that I think we need to take away. The first is, of course, much will depend on how the ANC and the government, how they respond over the next few months, and the degree of implementation and prosecution. Because nothing is more significant than to show one or two serious prosecutions that will indicate to the country that there are issues being taken seriously here in the light of the Zondo report. Then it's very striking to me the extent to which the capture and indeed the corruption which has been revealed by the Zondo report does revolve around state-owned enterprises and local government. I think that's quite important to keep that focus, because it does indicate why we need reforms, both in respect of our state-owned enterprises and urgently at the local government level. It comes back to this concept that perhaps the risk of all this going wrong was very high when you spoke about a developmental state and didn't build the safeguards in that were needed. That's why I say it would be much more acceptable to talk about a delivery state. What do we need to do now to ensure a delivery state? And then the economic damage caused by, of course, the cadre deployment, which has been emphasized by the Zondo Commission. This has been like sand. It's got in everywhere, and it's interrupted good decision-making, good implementation, and issues of merit and efficiency were obviously sidelined. We must understand that this was a tool of patronage, and that's what many governments do. And once you abandon those disciplines and you go for the patronage route and the cadre deployment route, you end up with the Zondo Commission and its findings. And then finally, I think that the private sector can't just point fingers at the government or the ANC. I think it must ask itself, what are the implications for those businesses, perhaps very dysfunctional and dishonest as some of them were. The fact remains that I would like to see that instrument of the King Report, which we have, I think, number four or five now, which has been produced over the years to discipline good governance in the private sector. I think what needs to be done by organized business and the other institutions is now to take the Zondo Commission and say, how do we update this King Report in terms of what that has to be done on the corporate governance side. So really the bottom line is we've got to use Zondo Commission findings to rebuild confidence in key institutions in South Africa so that we get a better economic performance.
And I think as that bottom line, Warwick, I'm sure all of us now are saying, well, what next? You know, we've had 4 years, we've had over 5,000 pages really forensically reveal where things went wrong. If we're to build the guardrails and the safeguards to ensure that this doesn't happen again, surely for me, and Raymond touched on it, one of the big issues is cadre deployment. That really enabled the capture of the state. And in the report, Zondo pretty much calls cadre deployment unconstitutional in the way that an unelected body is influencing the appointment of civil servants. So the big acid test for me is to see whether or not the ANC, as the ruling party, can self-reflect on this policy and do away with it. Or are we being naive in expecting the ANC to respond in such a fashion?
Well, I think it's a prisoner of its past decisions. And you've now got an embedded situation. So unraveling the creation is obviously going to be quite difficult. I think, though, what it does point towards is, you know, we've often had the developmental state types look at free market types like me and say, well, you hate the government. Well, actually, free market types don't hate the government. What they do want is a very functional state and a government that actually does what it says it's going to do, but does it effectively and competently. And that, of course, is the real problem with cadre deployment, is that it's just a club, a bit of a country club. That's all it is. And you can't run a country like that.
Yeah, with patronage at its core, to Raymond's earlier point. Either, what is your big takeaway from the Zondo report if we're to look at it and say, right, how do we move on from here? How do we draw a line under this and ensure that we never return to the days of state capture?
I think looking at the reforms that have been taking place over the last 3 or 4 years, this puts, you know, significant risk of a potential slowdown in those reforms, even, you know, taking into account that they're already moving at a very slow pace than what we would want to see. Now, you have implementation of all the recommendations from the Zondo Commission that needs to take place, also alongside the continuation of economic reforms that are required for economic growth. I'm not sure that is going to be possible, because many of the role players that are in the economic space that should push the economic reforms are the same role players that will be impacted potentially negatively from the implementation of the Zondo Commission's recommendations. So my worry is over the next couple of quarters, we might see a slowdown in implementation of reforms while the political space tries to sort itself out of the Zondo Commission recommendations, which then means we will have a negative impact domestically. At the same time, we have things that are dragging growth from the global environment. What a double whammy to have at the wrong time.
Yeah, and we're really seeing...
If I could add to that, just while we're talking about it, say I agree with that in two ways. Firstly, we must dismiss the fact that this debate about the Zondo Commission and the efficiency of government is an ideological issue. It's not. Whether you believe in big government or small government, you want it to be efficient. You want it to deliver. And you want to put in place whatever mechanisms and institutions will reverse what has been done and put us in a far better place. And the second point is, yes, I've said before, I think whether it's Zondo or our wish to see more reforms or whatever other sort of constructive policies we want to follow from the point of view of our economy, I come back to my point that in the next 6 months or so, that the gross domestic product, as I like to say, is also the gross domestic politics. And that simply means not that you wring up your hands and say, well, that's nothing's going to happen. It simply says that what Zondo is saying, there is an additional challenge to good leadership now, whether it's in government or in the private sector. Mm. Whether that will happen or not, I think we all have our own views. Yeah. But that challenge has now been very definitively put on the table by by the Zondo Commission.
Amidst other economic events concerning major issues like the global economy, inflation and interest rates, last week the outcome of the WTO ministerial conference received very little attention in our media, certainly, yet unexpected progress was made in a key global institution in very difficult circumstances for a major rule-setting international organization like the WTO, which has been undermined and operationally stalemated for several years. The latest WTO meeting was at last able to successfully conclude and chalk up a credible range of narrow trade agreements under new leadership. Its African-American Director General appointed last year probably was also able to nudge a few things along at the WTO. The recent meeting could mark a turning point for the organization in reinforcing global trade rules at a time when rising protectionism and economic balkanization are really developing without much challenge to the world economy. These latest agreements covered areas like progress on avoiding digital tariffs, conflicts over patent rights and access to vaccines. So, Raymond, how do we now assess the future role of the WTO in general and from South Africa's perspective in particular?
Well, Michael, I think in a nutshell, we like to talk about us being a small open economy. Well, small open economies need a policeman of the marketplace, and that happens in this case to be, as far as trade is concerned, the World Trade Organization. It's had a bad spell, but we have a vested interest in a rule-based setup that tries to set some broad framework within which all the nations of the world ought to operate in terms of their foreign trade, their imports and their exports. So this policeman of the marketplace has been somewhat absent recently for all sorts of problems which we won't go into now. But the fact that it has achieved some success in its recent meetings is, I think, a step in the right direction. Or as someone might have said, one small step for our world trade, one big step for the WTO. And I think under the new Director General, they're making some progress and showing a degree of leadership in untying some of those technical problems about which they had a success. So I think really the important point now is that what we want to do is to support the WTO as South Africa, encourage these new developments, and bearing in mind that closer to home, that the WTO has been very supportive of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. So that's another reason why I think we should welcome this progress and reinforce the role of the WTO, given the fact that we are inevitably living in a world of rising protectionism, increasing economic balkanization, that obviously in trying to resolve any conflicts, it is good that the WTO is now in a better position to be able to help to resolve and decide what the new rules of the game will need to be in the light of these new challenges.
Yeah, the world needs a strong WTO now in particular. And then BRICS, Isa, there's a lot of cozying up to President Putin at BRICS, talk about buying Russian oil by Guedes Montash, and then obviously the talk about a special drawing rights type reserve currency amongst BRICS nations. Do we take any of this seriously?
Indeed, Michael, we have to take this seriously. You know, in a world where there are clear differences between the global north and the global south, you also have Russia and China on the one side of the Ukraine war, Europe and the US on the other side. In other instances, we have the West pushing for faster decarbonization, essentially meaning a faster end to the use of coal on the one side, while poorer nations are saying, you know, with their yearning for energy security and development, most of which are in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. And then we saw during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, the rich countries hoarding vaccines, while poor nations were in dire need to save lives and livelihoods. And then you look at the UN Security Council, five permanent members that still exhibit the post-World War II architecture. It hasn't changed in 77 years. Now, within that framework, the BRICS countries offer something to say, let's reform these institutions in a way that helps or benefits a lot of the emerging markets, which constitute a significant portion of the global population. The BRICS countries alone, 40% of the global population. Now, they are no longer representing themselves alone. They represent the aspirations of emerging markets and poorer countries as a whole. So it's quite important to follow what they do. And in times of war, China's leadership is quite important when you have the U.S. that has assumed that leadership historically, taking sides and aggravating wars rather than calming it down. So it's quite important to follow the developments that are happening within the BRICS nations.
Yeah, so much more than just the acronym that Jim O'Neill coined. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Isaac Mplunga, Chief Economist at Alex Forbes, who's joined around the table by Warwick Lucas, Head of Galileo Securities, and Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, putting the week into perspective here on Business Watch.